Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. More than any war in the past, members of the American military are surviving their life-threatening injuries. And a new generation of the war wounded, now at home, are facing high physical and emotional tolls. Their stories are told in a new documentary from HBO, interspliced with footage from insurgents of explosions and survived surprise attacks. This film offers a harrowing picture of the war. This hour, On Point, we hear from a roundtable of young veterans back from the war. Joining me now are two veterans who narrowly escaped death in Iraq. They're featured in an HBO documentary, Alive Day Memories, Home from Iraq, which airs on September 9th. First, from Washington, D.C., is Captain Dawn Halfacre. While on patrol in Bakuba, Iraq, 3 years ago, she was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade, and to save her life, doctors had to amputate her right arm and her shoulder. Dawn, it's nice to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for having me.
And with us from Norfolk, Virginia, is Corporal Jonathan Bartlett. As he was finishing a mission near Fallujah, Iraq, in September 2004, an IED tore through his Humvee, and he lost both of his legs. Jonathan, great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
No problem, Jim. And hi, Dawn.
I know you and Dawn are friends. I'm glad that you're together here today. Dawn, let me start with you and tell us what a live day is, what it means. It's the title of this documentary. What is an alive day?
Well, I think alive day is just, it's a huge paradox. It's the day that, you're grateful that you're still alive, but it's the day that, your life has changed forever and, you carry the ravages of war sort of with you, and you have to, in many ways, just start your life over.
And what do you remember about your alive day?
I remember a lot of it, but I remember it in bits and pieces. I was injured pretty badly, and I was in a lot of pain. I remember the explosion. I remember the smells, the sounds, the bright flashes, and things like that. I remember some of the reactions from the people who were trying to save me and work on me. I just remember what it felt like being finally lifted up into a helicopter, knowing that I was hopefully going to one of the military hospitals.
Did you know at the time that you would lose your arm and your shoulder? You were in an induced coma, I know, for 10 days. But after the attack, did you realize the severity of your injuries?
No, I really didn't. It was amazing how your body and your senses are just in chaos, and you don't really... I was more worried. I remember just being more worried about trying to be sort of in control of the situation in terms of, we were getting hit. So what should our reaction be? Are we firing back at them? Is my driver okay? Can he get us out of here? So that was more what I was worried about. And I didn't even really notice the pain or the injury until we actually got back to inside the wire at a police station that we were living at in Bakuba. And so when they finally pulled me out, it was when I was laying on the ground that it just the pain set in and a little bit of the reality that, oh my gosh, like I'm hit.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did you realize that you, in fact, were going to lose your arm and your shoulder, and that life was going to be very different for you from that point on?
I definitely didn't know that when I was still in Iraq. The last thing I remember, I do remember them working a lot on the right side of my body, and I didn't really know the extent of my injury. At one point, I did sort of reach over. I knew I couldn't really move my right side. I tried to reach over, and I found my hand, which was just barely sort of hanging on to my body, and I lifted up my hand, and I couldn't feel anything, and I kind of threw it back down on the ground, and I just, you know, that was definitely a moment of some reality. And then I didn't really realize the full extent until I woke up at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C.
You went to West Point, and I wonder if you always wanted to serve in the military.
Well, I actually didn't know. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was fortunate enough to be an athlete. I was a basketball player, and I was recruited by West Point. It was one of the schools that was interested in me, and I got to admit, I really didn't know too much about it, and I hadn't really thought about the military at that point as a career. But I decided that it seemed like a very interesting opportunity. I was sort of intrigued just by the thought of it. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll go out and visit. So I went out to West Point, which is in New York. And I was just, the minute I stepped on the campus, I knew that it was the place I wanted to go.
And did you have a vision of, once you finished your West Point experience and you were in the military, did you have a vision of what you might expect in a situation that was wartime and eventually what you ended up in Iraq?
I can't say that I expected to, especially going through West Point. I mean, you know, this was all before 9/11. And though, you know, you join the military, everybody joins the military for different reasons. And so I can't say that I necessarily thought a lot about combat or what it would be like. I mean, you're always training to be a leader, no matter what situation you're put into. So I think that I was definitely prepared for the leadership aspect of it, but I don't think anyone's ever prepared for war.
When you watched this documentary, I wonder what your reaction was, Don, to seeing the insurgent video of the attack that injured you and took your arm. I wonder what it was like to watch someone videotaping that and hearing these insurgents talking and even laughing about detonating this explosive. What was it like to see that?
Well, I think that it's very haunting. I mean, I think that I don't necessarily take it personally, but it's just hard to watch that there are people out there that really want to kill you, you know. And I felt that my mission over in Iraq, I was very closely tied with the Iraqi people. I worked a lot with the police officers, and so I really, my heart was really in the mission, and I worked very hard and felt like I left, you know, my blood, sweat, and tears over there. And then, you know, just to see the other side of it and sort of the reality of who you're facing over there, it was very haunting, and it was a little, you know, kind of made my heart stop a little bit.
Jonathan Bartlett, I'd like to ask you why you joined the Army.
I joined the Army because I was 18 years old, young, and I watched 9/11, and when 9/11 happened, I was in my U.S. government and my U.S. history class, so I was like, well, I have to do something about this. And my parents were in the Navy, and I couldn't swim, so I joined the Army. And I went off and became a soldier. And I always felt like I was, you know, doing, you know, fighting the good fight, doing all that. This is when I was, you know, idealistic and horribly romantic and didn't pay attention much to, you know, anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know.
And then in 2004, September, you were finishing a mission near Fallujah.
Yep.
And what happened?
I don't remember. Mm-hmm. See, I took a massive head wound. My head went through the steering wheel. Not my helmet, my head. The nasal passages and whatnot in the front of my skull are all sealed up because I crushed them. And I don't remember that whole week. Now, I was cognizant. Apparently, I was talking to people, and, you know, things were said, and apparently I knocked out a medic, but because I, you know, put the tourniquet down on my left leg, and it hurt a lot. But I don't remember any of it. I was all told what happened. What I was told what happened was when I was, you know, we were evacuating the area. We were leaving. As we were leaving, we came across a T-crossing, you know, like a three-way crossing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taking a right, and I drove like Evel Knievel because, you know, you had to avoid fire and bombs and things of that nature. And there wasn't anything on the road because it was in the middle of farmland, so we were driving and it exploded. It was 3 bombs under my Humvee, 1 under the front left tire, 1 behind us, and 1 just to the right of the right tire. Itch picked the truck up, spun it, tore the front end off. What wasn't torn off was put into my seat. I got, you know, pushed out of the door, and I got 1 leg ripped off in the truck, and the other one was so horribly damaged that they had to take it off. And I had corneal scarring. I have a bunch of shrapnel still coming out of me, and you know, I have a bunch of phantom pain. But other than that, I'm groovy. And that's what happened.
And this all happened to you as an 18-year-old, 19-year-old?
I was 19 at the time.
Kid.
Well, I was a soldier, but yeah,
a
pretty
soldier.
Much kid.
Do you remember, I know in the film you said you felt angry at the time and for a period after, quite understandably.
Yeah, because,
you know. Do you feel that now?
I'm more angry now at the weather. Because if the weather was colder and nicer, I'd be able to wear my legs more often. You know, because in the heat, it becomes very difficult to walk around and you know, in the sun and the shine and enjoy everything when it's, you know, 98 degrees and 100% humidity. Because I will sweat out of my legs and fall down and hurt myself, which isn't good. I'm more angry now at the nonsense going on in government than the fact that I lost my legs. Because, you know, I can do stuff now.
Captain Halfacre, I'm interested to hear with your injuries and coming home and reintegrating yourself into life. I remember in the film when they showed video of your homecoming, and I remember the look on your face. And I wanted to ask you what you were thinking during that time, being surrounded with your family and your friends, and yet being a world away from what you had experienced in the horror of war.
Well, the homecoming was something, it was very special to me because it was, you know, people from my community that I grew up in getting together and really just, you know, showing their support for the way I looked at it, not only me, but everybody that's serving and continues to serve and is making sacrifices. And I was just I was obviously very honored, but also just surprised that, you know, I didn't really feel that I deserved anything special. I, like I tell everyone, I mean, I really was just doing my job and, you know, I was doing the best that I could. And, you know, my situation was somewhat unfortunate. And, you know, coming back and then recovering at Walter Reed, there's just a lot of different stages that you go through. And so it was definitely a milestone. I think it was the first time that I went back home to, I'm from San Diego, California, and going back and just really feeling the support from my community and my family and my friends was amazing.
And how did people approach you? Did they talk to you about your experience? Did you want to talk about it? Did you want to share the fact that, you know, you were so badly injured, lost your arm and your shoulder? Was there a nervousness attached to that and remembering that?
Yeah, I was definitely nervous. I mean, this is still pretty early on in my recovery. And I just remember being a little bit unsure about how people were going to react to me only having one arm. I mean, that was a lot of my concern. You know, it was some of the ceremonies and things like that were taped, and there were news reporters there. And so, you know, it was, okay, do I want to be on TV? You know, I look different. I'm missing an arm. And there was a lot of anxiety, I think, that went with that. But it was quickly swept away by just the support that I had by the people that were there. I mean, especially a lot of the children. They were very curious and inquisitive and appreciative. And so how could I be thinking about myself and being self-conscious when everybody was just making it such a wonderful experience?
I want to play a clip from the HBO documentary Alive Day Memories, Home from Iraq. Here you are talking about coping with your injury.
I feel so high maintenance. I mean, I went from being a soldier, you know, I peed in water bottles. I mean, I really wanted to lead soldiers in combat. I wanted that experience. I wanted to be put to the test. But I remember there was a very distinct moment when I finally realized what I was. I was an amputee from the war. And I was just like the guys I saw that were missing two legs or that had, you know, extensive facial scarring or burns or a bad brain injury. I mean, I was one of them.
And what did it make you feel like to be one of them, Don?
Well, I think what I was talking about, what I was alluding to, was my first visit going. I was in Ward 57. A lot of people have heard of that. It's where they put most of the amputees from the war. And, you know, but I wasn't really up and around yet. I had come out of a coma, just still trying to get my bearings, still, you know, undergoing a lot of surgeries. But for me, sort of the turning point in really the reality of this whole thing setting in was when I finally went downstairs to what's the physical therapy clinic, and, you know, being able to interact and see some of the other amputees. Because, I mean, when there's definitely an element of selfishness when you first get injured. You know, you first wake up and you're just thinking about yourself. You're saying, oh my gosh, like, look what happened to me. I can't believe this. And then, you know, and being a healthy, able-bodied soldier over in Iraq, you know, you don't think about the people that are back at Walter Reed and missing limbs. I mean, it's really not a side of the Army that I had seen at all or really had to deal with up until that point. And so I just remember walking in, well, I didn't walk in, getting wheeled in to the physical therapy clinic and just immediately, you know, seeing like 10 people that were all missing limbs. And I thought, oh my gosh, wow, I'm one of them. This is my new reality. And it wasn't necessarily, it was just more of a moment of realization than anything else. And because I think that it doesn't really set in when you don't have to look at yourself or you don't have to, you know, do the activities of daily living. When you're just laying in a bed and, you know, the only people around you are your family, it's really easy to just sit there in denial. But, you know, so that's definitely the moment when reality set in.
And Corporal Jonathan Bartlett, when did reality set in for you after losing both legs and realizing that there was going to be a very different kind of life that you were going to be living?
Well, let me give you some idea of the way I was raised. The first thing my father said to me when I woke up in the hospital was, oh, the defeated one wakes. Defeated, it's a joke. I didn't have my feet anymore. I thought it was real funny, and then I realized that he wasn't kidding. But my family raised me to be very, you know, to deal with whatever comes by, because, you know, growing up was kind of rough. And, I mean, it wasn't like the worst, you know, like living in the ghetto or, you know, getting shot at every day. It was just, emotionally, it was very rough and gruff. And my family, you know, we joke about everything. We make jokes. And it's not like it's not important. But, I mean, I was raised in a family that if everyone didn't pick on you, it's because they didn't like you. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of buried it all till about a year ago, actually, when I started going to therapy. Now, mm-hmm. I realized that, you know, people are going to look at me a certain way. People are going to talk to me a certain way. And I was stuck in a wheelchair for a very long time, so everyone, you know, wanted to do everything, wanted to get everything, wanted mm-hmm. to make everything okay and cushy and make sure I wouldn't hurt myself. But that really, really, really annoyed me. And I made an effort to, you know, be self-sufficient. Like, I can do it, I can do this, I can do that. And I learned to do gymnastics on my wheelchair to, you know, get things on the top shelf and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And then when I started walking, I practiced walking obsessively until I got it to the point where, you know, they told me I wouldn't be able to walk without crutches. Then they told me I wouldn't be able to walk without two canes. I mean, now I walk around without a cane, without help. You know, I don't. If I was wearing pants and you saw me on the street, you wouldn't be able to tell.
Mm. I want to play a clip from you from the HBO film Alive Day. Here you are talking about what it means to be a soldier.
I had invested so much into being a soldier, into defending my country, that it was like the glass that I was on shattered on the floor. Everything went away. There was nothing, because I couldn't be in the military anymore. I could, but I couldn't do what I wanted to do. I couldn't do what I was good at. It tore me up. Like, every time I looked into that mirror of what I used to be or what I was, I saw somebody trying to stand up, and there was all this blood and pain, and he couldn't stand up. He couldn't do anything. He just lied there and screamed. It was bad.
I remember shortly after that in the film, you said that when you were in the hospital, you cried a lot. Does that still happen? I can imagine that you would. Do you get overwhelmed and break down? I mean, what causes this sort of reliving of what you went through?
I've put a lot of that to rest, actually. I think more like a statesman and a businessman now. I'm in college for business than a soldier. I mean, it really did break me up that I couldn't be a soldier anymore. Hmm. But I started going to school, and I started taking classes, and I started, you know, going to therapy, and got rid of the girl I was dating, and which, you know, it wasn't her fault. It's just that she was like the bandage. She made everything okay.
And you've since married, and you've moved on.
Yes, I've since married and moved on. Mm-hmm. But she was like the bandage that made everything okay. I didn't have to deal with anything because she would always be there and, you know, make you feel better about yourself, and you didn't have to work too hard because it would be okay because it's not your fault. But then we broke up, and things were my fault because, you know, if I'm not going to do something, no one else is going to do it for me. And, you know, I had to start going to therapy and dealing with, you know, the sort of inferiority complex you develop when you're stuck in a wheelchair all the time. Because, you know, people do kind of look at you and they, like, want to subtract 50 IQ points from where you're at because you're in a wheelchair. Mm. They do it subconsciously. It's not really their fault. And then they talk to you for more than 10 minutes and they're amazed that you, you know, you do so well.
Don, I want to turn to you for a moment because in the film, you know, Jonathan just talked about moving on, and you talk about at some point moving on yourself and having a family and having children. And I remember so moving to hear you speak about how your injury will affect a family life at some point. And you got quite emotional talking about never being able to pick up your child. And I wonder if you'd talk about that for a moment.
Well, never being able to pick up my child with two arms. But yeah, no, it's definitely something that is on my mind from time to time. Somebody asked me about that actually today, and you know, I thought about it, and they said, well, you know, when do you think about things like that? And I thought, you know, well, it's when I'm walking down the street and I see parents interacting with their children, or you know, or two kids interacting with one another, and it's just sometimes it'll strike me and in a moment, and I'll, you know, I'll say, you know, I wonder, things will be different with me. I mean, if I have a family or I have children, I mean, hopefully I can still have, you know, a rich and full life and be a good parent if that's in my path. But it'll be different than other people.
In the film, you said you were very self-conscious about your prosthetic arm. You talked about being on the subway and people bumping your arm or somebody asking you what time it is and being self-conscious about not being able to lift up your arm. Do you still feel that? Is that a sort of an ongoing concern and issue?
Yeah, it comes and goes, and I think it depends a lot. What I'm realizing is it just depends on the situation that I'm in and who I'm with. You know, a lot of times I don't think about it, especially when I'm with my friends or my family, people I'm very comfortable with that I know just, you know, don't care. But for example, I just started school. I'm doing my master's part-time at Georgetown University, and we had our first class last night, and, you know, and I remember walking into class sort of wondering, okay, well, who's going to be sort of staring at me, maybe thinking, like, what's wrong with her arm, or, and then, you know, sitting down, and then they were passing out some papers and things like that, and, you know, it's like you fumble with the paper a little bit, and people wonder, like, well, you know, what's her deal? And so, yeah, you know, I do think about it.
I'd like to bring in now from New York City, John Alpert, the filmmaker. He directed HBO's Alive Day Memories, Home from Iraq. John, it's nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Nice to talk to you again.
What was your goal with this film?
Well, I think it's part of HBO's commitment and Sheila Nevins and Jim Gandolfini's commitment to bring more information from Iraq to the American people, and in this particular case, to help people like Dawn and John tell their stories. I think that as I'm listening to Dawn and John, they're telling me things that I haven't heard before, and they're over there making sacrifices for us, and a lot of people have no idea what's going on. And HBO's made a commitment to bring as much information as they possibly can about the war in Iraq back to the American people. It's the same thing that you're doing with your show. This is a war that a lot of people aren't paying attention to. On Sunday night, instead of watching this, they might watch the football game, and it's something that's happening far away, but it's affecting your neighbors, people like Dawn and John.
How did you find these soldiers, John, and was it hard to get them to talk to you about the experiences that they had to relive what happened to them?
Unfortunately, there are a lot of people like Dawn and John that have come back from the war. Many, many, many people have been wounded. As you can tell from listening to them, these are two extremely self-effacing, intelligent, frank people who can really express themselves. I think their injuries are typical of the people who have been wounded in Iraq, and that's why we chose them, and we met them before. We brought them to New York to talk to Jim Gandolfini and found that we thought American people needed to hear their stories.
This film is not at all political. There are no political statements made. You do not take a side. You just hear the stories. Was that intentional from the beginning?
Well, I don't think it's it's certainly not political in terms of anybody saying that this particular war is bad. It's political in the sense that I think both Dawn and John would tell you what they think about war in general, and I think that's important for the American people to think about and to discuss. We're a really powerful country. Sometimes we're like a bull in a china shop. Sometimes we will deploy our forces, perhaps without the American people thinking about all the consequences. Dawn and John can help you understand what those consequences are. And in that sense, it's extremely political. But in terms of trying to pick a fight about this war, I certainly didn't want to do that. But whatever Dawn and John wanted to say, we were ready to let them express it.
How was the decision made to use the insurgent video? Because I have to tell you, in some places, it was hard to watch.
Makes me mad when I see it.
Mm-hmm.
I've been over in Iraq 5 times already. But it was frightening to see that. The insurgents take and videotape many of their activities, and they do a couple of things with it. One, they put it on the Internet as a recruiting tool, and they hope that people will see the effect of their bombs and think that they're a strong force worthy of joining. And the other thing they do is they drop it off at our bases to mock us, sort of like a nan-nan-nan-nan, look what we did to you last night. And I've watched the show many times, and it's very scary.
John Alpert is the filmmaker who directed HBO's Alive Day Memories Home from Iraq, debuts on HBO on September 9th. John, it's great to have you with us. Thank you.
All right, appreciate it.
Don, I'm curious if you're glad you served in Iraq. Would you do it again?
Would I do it again? I would say that I don't have any regrets. Would I do it again right now? I don't think so. But do I regret anything or would I have changed any decisions leading up to, in my life that led up to me, deploying to Iraq? I don't think I would.
Why?
Well, I think that, every experience that I've had, especially, since attending West Point and beyond, I mean, it really has shaped sort of the person that I am, and the experiences that I've had, I really wouldn't want to trade for anything. Do I wish I had an arm? Absolutely. I mean, but fortunately, that choice was made for me. I don't have to pick, my life now versus, would I give it all back to still have an arm and not do what I did? I don't think I would do that, but I don't have to make that decision.
Jonathan, at one point in the film, you say you would do it all over again, and then later you said that if given your legs back, you'd move on to something else. How do you feel now?
I said I would have. Like, if they'd have slapped new legs on me in the hospital, I'd have done it in a quick second.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time of the documentary, I was well involved in school and as well as the other things I'm going to do with my life. Now, it'd be nice to be able to do the two-step and, dance around and run, but, it has changed my perception on the world, and I see things from a different angle that I didn't see. Because, getting a traumatic injury and dying a couple times causes you to mature vastly,
mm-hmm.
at a vastly accelerated rate. And I rather like the way I see things now.
And how do you see them differently?
Well, I'm a 22-year-old male. I'm supposed to, you know, guys who are 22, they're supposed to go off and do a bunch of silly things and hurt themselves in various ways that men want to do, you know, and men especially don't really pay attention to the world around them until they've got families or careers and things of that nature. Like, most of the guys I know in college, just, you know, they go to college. They pay attention to sports. They, you know, most of them aren't incredibly angry like I am at the crap that's going on in D.C. at the moment. And, you know, they're not as aware of all this stuff that is being led to slide and the way our country is going. And that kind of stuff really, really upsets me. It used to upset me before, but not nearly to the degree. Like, I can't watch Fox anymore. It makes me too angry.
Don, do you keep track of the news? Do you watch the news? Do you watch what's going on?
Well, like Jonathan said, I mean, you know, having been over there and lived through this experience, I mean, you grow up a lot. You have to. And so it is difficult to, you know, watch time and time again the effects of war and hearing about, you know, the KIA, the WIA, because, you know, that was us and we know what it's like. We know sort of what the future holds for the survivors. And it's very difficult, and it is a little bit frustrating. But, you know, just, again, I'm here in Washington, actually, and it's hard to get away from it. Mm-hmm. But it is difficult.
I'd like to invite our listeners to speak with you both and to join our conversation. First is Dennis, who's calling from Chesapeake, Virginia. Hi, Dennis, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hey, Jane, how are you?
Hi, good.
I have a question for both of them. I would assume both of them were medically retired from the service. And how do they feel that they will not receive both their retire pay and their VA pay because they didn't do 20 years in the service?
Dennis, thank you. Don, you want to start? How are you being treated, medically speaking, financially speaking?
My experience has been mostly positive. I feel that I'm getting the care that I need. I had a very good experience at Walter Reed. I guess I'm faring okay with the VA system, though it is difficult. I don't have a price tag necessarily on my sacrifice or anything like that. So, you know, I do okay. I think that there definitely needs to be some changes to the system, and I think that we do need to continue to work hard to ensure that veterans, especially the wounded veterans or the widows or the survivors, are getting the care and the benefits that they need.
Let's go back to the phones and Lindsay, who's calling from Clarksville, Tennessee. Hi, Lindsay. Go ahead. You're on the line.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I was a former sergeant. I'm actually almost. I got another week or so until I'm officially out of the military, but I served with the 1st Brigade Combat Team with the 101st Airborne in Iraq, and my unit is actually in a couple of weeks about to embark on their third deployment. But one of the things that I was a military journalist, and I was with an infantry brigade, and so I was, you know, kind of able to see all the different levels and activities going on from, you know, the ground forces up to the high-ranking officials, meeting with government officials. And one of the most starkest, I think, things that I remember from being over there was the politics that was starting to emerge behind the number of injured soldiers that we had. One of the battalions in my brigade took much more severe hits than the rest of them because of the area in which they were located. And it got to the point where the battalion commander was submitting so many applications and the paperwork for the Purple Heart Awards and the Bronze Stars that at one point the higher-ranking officials kind of put a quota on the number of awards that they could submit. So even though we had soldiers with, you know, shrapnel wounds up and down their body and, you know, other type of severe wounds and, you know, a lot of heroic things going on, this paperwork was being kicked back, and it was kind of known that this was being done because there were higher-ranking officials, you know, command sergeants, majors, and so forth, that were needing to try and get these awards themselves, even though they hadn't experienced, you know, virtually any type of wound. And I just, I think the fact that it's gotten to the point where we're politicizing injuries, and then these kids who are coming home, I mean, I'm going through the VA process now, and it's an absolute nightmare for some of these soldiers, especially the infantry.
I really appreciate your story, and I appreciate you calling. It brings up a good point. You know, 90% of soldiers in this war are surviving their injuries. So what about the politics of these injured soldiers? Don and Jonathan, you know, our caller tells an incredible story.
Yeah, when Don had a, she has a decent experience with the VA. When I left Walter Reed, I had what were called test sockets for my legs. Now, these are prosthetics that are supposed to last about 2 weeks. I walked on them for about 8 months. And then it came time I had to get them replaced because they weren't fitting, and it appeared they were going to snap on me because they were essentially held together by casting material. Like you get when you break a bone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I went to I asked around and went to a local prosthetic company, which is Tidewater Prosthetics. They're really, really good, and they told me the VA should pay for it all, you know. So I went to the local VA, and I started the process, and they told me, oh, no, you don't need to do prosthetics. Those are fine. And I walked on them until they snapped. Like, I fell in a crowded mall, which, you know, it was embarrassing, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
And it enraged me, because
mm-hmm.
I hadn't brought my wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to, like, write a bunch of nasty letters and, you know, legal action and that kind of thing before the VA would pay for my prosthetics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're supposed to pay for them regardless of everything. I mean, the VA is there to give veterans help. You don't have to use it. Like, for example, I use my TRICARE and go to Portsmouth Medical Hospital more than I go to the VA. I go to the VA for my benefits, my education, and my prosthetics. Because if I went through TRICARE for my prosthetics, it cost me like $20,000 to pop. And I don't have that kind of money.
So your experience has not been the best. Well, let me turn to another call, because another caller, John, in Lake Placid, New York, would like to ask you a question and join us. John, go ahead. Hello.
Yes, hi. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Okay, yes. Actually, I'm both for this service and appreciate your sacrifice. I'm actually a veteran of the Gulf War back in 1990. I'd like to ask you both dealing with the...
John, I'm sorry that we're having some problems with your calls, but I think John's question was, how are you both faring socially and mentally now that you're back in the States? You know, how are you sort of fitting in? Don, do you want to start?
I think that there's definitely an adjustment period, and it's different for everybody. As far as my situation is concerned, at the very, very beginning, I was still just, I felt very lucky to be alive. I was, and like I said before, I was surrounded by family, and that was great. But then that definitely wore off, and then I was, you know, faced with the reality of actually going back into society and not just being in a hospital environment where it's, you know, at Walter Reed, it's kind of normal to be an amputee. It's like, well, what are you mm-hmm. doing with all your limbs? You're, you know, weirdo. But then having to actually go back into, you know, an environment like in downtown Washington, D.C., let's say, you know, I walk around and I look around and I think, oh, my gosh, like, I'm the only person that looks this way. And so it's very, very difficult. It's overwhelming. And then there is sort of an emotional burden that comes with that. And then just wondering, you know, in my case, being a female, how people react to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I hear a lot of people talk a lot about, you know, there are very few people, a very small portion of our population that actually serves and that actually has sacrificed in this war. And I think there are a lot of people who wonder, well, what can I do? For those who are hurt, those who are injured, you know, what's your response to that, John and Don? What should the average person do or think or feel, not just when they see someone like you who has sacrificed in person, but sort of generally speaking? Jonathan?
I roll around a lot in the summer in wheelchair and whatnot. And unlike Don, when I wear my prosthetics, I actually have to point it out to people because they don't notice. Because people pay attention to shapes more than they pay attention to details. But I would say the best thing you could do is if someone tells you that, you know, they went off and they got hurt in the war, You don't ask them silly questions like, so did you kill anybody? That's a silly question. You don't ask them silly things like, does it hurt? Or did it hurt? Because that infuriates me, especially. I had a real big discussion with a bunch of vets the other day on when people say, thank you for your service, as to whether or not they actually do thank you, or it's their way of saying, well, I'm sorry because you got hurt. Don't ever pity us, because, you know, we don't pity ourselves, most of us. I mean, there are a lot of vets who are really depressed about it still. They've gotten hurt, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, and they're still depressed about it. But a lot of them, most of them, are not. They have their lives, they have their families, they have their loved ones, and chances are they're doing pretty good, you know, financially, monetarily, education-wise, with their careers. We're not, you know, to be pitied or looked down upon.
Mm-hmm. Felt sorry, you know, for.
That's it, especially, felt sorry for. I really hate that.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back to another caller. Peter is in Boston. Hi, Peter, go ahead. You're on the line.
Yes, hi. Outstanding program, as usual. And my again, congratulations for the great service of these young veterans. I'm a 1st Marine Division combat veteran of Vietnam, and I can tell that these young people, unfortunately, we had a lot. I was at Chelsea Naval Hospital, and at that time we had guys were coming out of Way City and Kaesong. We were just flogged with people. And I can just tell them that, unfortunately, the system doesn't work so great, but the VA over the years has done a pretty good job. They just can't get disappointed and hang in there. The other thing I was just going to kind of comment is that, you know, with the injuries they have, I mean, unfortunately, you got to put in perspective, hey, we're alive. And, you know, I look at the guys in 1st Marines I was with at Way City at Kaesong, and so many of them are dead. Forget to, you know. And you keep that in perspective, and I think if they meet with some of the other combat vets, particularly combat vets, and that was my experience, were very helpful for me were World War II and Korean vets who were in combat, particularly Marines. And I think if they can get support people with the people that they're in to kind of, you know,
move
forward, put things in perspective. Hey, we're alive, we're going forward, and I take my hat off to them. And, you know, and absolutely should never look like to be pitied. I mean, hey, you go forward. And I think they're doing a heck of a job, but I just ask them to, like, kind of look at that part. And particularly, I know some of the VFWs and all these things, but you do get some time to, when you meet with the combat veterans, the bona fide ones, you know, they can be helpful and they can help you deal with things. And, you know, there's a real bonding with the brotherhood. The people have been up there
and I know that these guys have felt that. Peter, thank you for your call. Don, I wanted you to talk about your future. You have started a consulting firm in Washington, D.C., a national security consulting firm. What's ahead for you? What's your future?
Well, like I always say, I feel lucky to make it through each day. But certainly I feel very blessed to have this company. You know, I have some of my closest friends that I get to work with every day, which is a delight. And having a company has really given me an opportunity. It's sort of a vehicle to, you know, accomplish my goals, and sort of a reflection of what I think is important. And, you know, maybe we can use it to provide employment for veterans, things like that, down the road. And so I'm optimistic.
And are you optimistic, Jonathan?
Oh, yes, enormously so. I'm a business student in college now, and a friend of mine told me I was going to take over the free world $1 at a time.
I'm currently trying to recruit Jonathan. So
you'd make a good team. I know you would. Listen, I really appreciate you coming on today to tell us your stories. Captain Don Halfacre from Washington, thanks so much, and good luck.
Thank you, Jean.
And Corporal Jonathan Bartlett from Norfolk, Virginia. Thanks so much to you, Jonathan.
Yeah, no problem, Jane.
And when I say thanks for your service, I do mean it. Thank you.
Oh, I know.
The documentary is Alive Day Memories, Home from Iraq, and it airs on HBO on September 9th. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, he'll be back on Monday. This is On Point.